TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. A brief history of unprosecuted Israeli smuggling and espionage cases by Grant F. Smith and Alison Weir, founder of If Americans Knew, What Every American Needs to Know About Israel-Palestine. Alison Weir and Grant Smith were the lead organizers of the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship, held on March 7, 2014, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. By strange coincidence, one of the topics covered by Grant Smith became international news, exactly as I was preparing his talk for broadcast on TUC Radio. On April 17, 2014, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists released an article with the intriguing title, Did Israel Steal Bomb-Grade Uranium from the United States? The article, written by Victor Gilinski and Roger J. Madsen, began, Last month, ICECAP, the nation's highest classification authority, released a number of top-level government memoranda that shed additional light on the so-called NUMEC affair. Gilinski and Madsen had suspected some time ago that Israel, in the 1960s, stole bomb-grade uranium from the Apollo, Pennsylvania plant of NUMEC, the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation. And they urged the U.S. government to declassify CIA and FBI documents to settle the matter. They now credit the release of documents in March 2014 that contained some of the proof they were looking for to the persistent appeals by researcher Grant Smith. And you will hear his part of the story in a moment. Grant Smith is executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. For the past 10 years, he has been investigating and writing articles and books concerning the role of Israel and its domestic lobby APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, in influencing U.S. Middle East policy. His 2012 book, Divert, contains the evidence that he found in declassified material of the theft of weapons-grade uranium by Israel. But before Grant Smith goes into the details of uranium smuggling, he covers the conventional weapons transfer as well as theft of World War II material from the U.S. to arm the Jewish underground in Palestine and prepare the founding of Israel in 1948. Here's Grant Smith.
Is Israel and its U.S. lobby above the law in the United States? I've spent 10 years trying to answer that question. I'm just going to share with you case studies very quickly. We got off on the wrong foot back in the 1940s. If you look closely enough, you can see ongoing damage from that poor launch in which the United States was visited by the government in waiting, the Jewish agency led by David Ben-Gurion, and rather than do anything else, they set up a vast illegal smuggling network through an archipelago of nonprofit organizations that were there specifically to steal World War II surplus and channel it to Jewish fighters in Palestine. Some of the material was bought for cents on the dollar. Some of the material was stolen outright from the U.S. Marines in Hawaii, as was the case of Nathan Liff and 50 caliber machine guns. The Sonnenborn Institute, which was organized by former Zionist Organization of America chair, was very effective in channeling via second and third countries all sorts of tank, ammunition, aircraft, explosives, and was able to get it for pennies on the dollar, completely in violation of the Arms Export Control Act and all sorts of laws, including the Neutrality Act. They cared little about Americans shipping material inside of boilers, inside of mismarked boxes dropping onto piers in New York. They didn't care about that because they had a higher purpose. That purpose was to win a state, and they were successful. If we look at some of the activities inside the Justice Department to cover up all of this, what you see is a very effective counterforce. Whenever the FBI was getting close, and there's a 7,000-page file in the National Archives with surveillance photographs of B-17s and materials and guns moving through the U.S. logistics system, what you would find is in the Justice Department's own files, lobbyists such as Abraham Feinberg, the Uber lobbyist, cash bundling king, would assemble a war chest and mobilize people to quash prosecutions. They had 100 people they were going to arrest and prosecute on the West Coast alone. Never happened. There were only a handful of people who actually suffered any felony convictions, relatively low-level people. The big fish of the Jewish agency, Nahum Bernstein, writing the checks from New York, never indicted. And this was because there was a vast amount of influence over the president, a vast amount of access to the Justice Department Attorney General. And so the basic advice and consent rights of Americans were fundamentally undermined. They had no choice. They had no say in what was happening to this military equipment. That had been decided for them, and the necessary prosecutions didn't happen. Hank Greenspun, he has a balcony on Pennsylvania Avenue named after him at the museum, became rich smuggling weapons to Palestine. He offered $25,000 to many people in Washington to quash those prosecutions, only got a felony. Well, some of these people graduated. One of the biggest problems in Pennsylvania right now is this. There is one plant that lost more highly enriched uranium, weapons-grade uranium, than any other nuclear fuel plant in the United States. It just happened to be run by two Zionist Organization of America officials, Ivan Novik and Zalman Shapiro, and a smuggler from the 1940s network of smuggling, David Lowenthal, who was very active with Israeli intelligence. So what happened to NUMEC? It was constantly inviting in the top spies from Israel to visit the plant. In particular, Rafael Itan, who would later run Jonathan Pollard, and a number of other extremely effective covert operations people. There were eyewitness accounts of Zalman Shapiro and other people sealing weapons-grade uranium into irradiators for shipment to Israel on an accelerated basis. And the amount of material unaccounted for today is 339 kilograms. They lost 2% of the entire throughput when Shapiro and the ZOA crew were in charge. It only went back down after they were forced out of ownership. What happened in the LBJ, Nixon, and subsequent administration? The record shows they were fearful of the political consequences of going after these people. They tried to move them around. They tried to assuage their concerns. But there are others who are more forthright. The CIA chief of the Tel Aviv station said, NUMEC was an Israeli operation from the beginning, and that is exactly what the record shows. Unfortunately for the people who have to live in the environs of a defunct weapons smuggling plant, they're facing a $500 million U.S. Army Corps of Engineer cleanup, and their water and township is completely polluted. Abraham Feinberg was also extremely effective providing seed funding to AIPAC, writing various checks. He also was the head of the organization that was, according to Abner Cohen, the prime organization for putting together fundraising for Israel's nuclear weapons research, the Weizmann Institute. He would also give money to AIPAC, which would write helpful articles such as Israel could never become a nuclear power, running a counter-propaganda ring whenever the U.S. was looking too closely. Now, there was a good question this morning about the 1938 Foreign Agents Registration Act. Why are Israel lobbying organizations which are closely coordinating with foreign principals and in some cases receiving money able not to be as transparent as other organizations that are lobbying for foreign principle? Simple fact of the matter is, when ordered to register, they don't. They fight it. When forced to register, they undergo a transformation into something else and continue their operations. And there's no better case of that than the case that led to the creation of AIPAC. But first, the Zionist organization was ordered 7 times to register because it was a subsidiary of the World Zionist Organization. But they, according to Justice Department documents by underlings, got to the AG who said, I'm not going to enforce the law. You don't have to register. You don't have to be transparent in your communications. The biggest attempt to register Israel lobbying groups in America was in the 1960s when the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the Justice Department, concerned about overseas provocations dragging America into war, they cited in their chartering investigative document the Levon affair twice, in other words, Israel twice, as being provoking activities that would draw America into unwise overseas interventions. And so they decided to raid the Jewish agency, to raid the American Zionist Council, seize documents, and saw that they were bringing in money from the Jewish agency for public relations and for publicity. So what happened? Well, they were ordered by the Justice Department to register as foreign agents in 1962. The unincorporated lobbying division, however, split off 6 weeks later and is still with us today. That organization is called the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and it continues the work of the original American Zionist Council that was ordered to shut down under this FARA order. So foreign agent registration orders have never really been applied rigorously, even in cases of documented violations of its transparency provisions. So what's happened because of that? Here's a snapshot of our worst free trade agreement ever signed, in which exports are half of what imports are. This is the U.S.-Israel Free Trade Agreement. It was lobbied against by 70 organizations in the mid-1980s, including Monsanto, Sunkist, AFL-CIO. They didn't want to lower U.S. trade barriers to Israel. On the other side was AIPAC and a group of small organizations. They stole the trade secrets of their opposition, which had been given to the International Trade Commission, and used it against them in public relations and lobbying, and got a heck of a deal for being able to, once again, thwart American interests and get it their own way. It's resulted in a chronic $10 billion per year deficit. It's resulted in a $100 billion cumulative deficit to the United States. And the question is, was it worth it? Well, yes, it created 120,000 jobs in a foreign country instead of here. It really transferred a lot of secrets to the Israelis about production costs, transfer pricing. And the Justice Department ultimately refused, even though they tracked it back to Dan Halpern of the Ministry of Economics, refused to continue the investigation when he claimed diplomatic immunity. So it's a bad deal, but it's not the only prosecution that's been thwarted. In December, we had declassified documents of a counter-espionage investigation of the ADL. The ADL back in the 90s had been investigated for holding FBI and other classified documents in a campaign that they were launching against pro-Palestinian and anti-apartheid activists, two of whom died under mysterious circumstances. But what the memos once again reveal, if you read them online, is that there was an intervention at high levels. The record reveals that 2 high-ranking Israeli generals were dispatched to talk to Janet Reno. She dropped the case. The espionage investigation died. 2005, the same thing happened. 2 AIPAC lobbyists were indicted. They were using secrets to try to gin up a war with Iran. They were passing it to Glenn Kessler. Steve Rosen said he was trying to show that Iran was engaged in total war against the U.S. in Iraq. And, of course, the Obama administration and the judges involved didn't keep it in the system. So it's gotten to the point of ridiculousness. We have other documents revealing a smuggling ring in the 80s that involved not only Arnon Milchan, Hollywood producer, and Richard Kelly Smith, but also Benjamin Netanyahu himself working on the Israeli side. Where are these people now? Have they ever suffered any consequences for being involved in the documented theft of nuclear triggers called Krytrons? No, Milchan was hiding out, you know, at the Academy Awards, clearly there in the center picture. He doesn't seem to be too afraid. And of course, Netanyahu is with his favorite coup here, AIPAC. The problem's ongoing. It hasn't gone away. Nuclear technology continues to flow from the United States, but we're not prosecuting it. We're disbanding them through regulations, or we're sealing off warranted criminal investigations instead of pursuing them, such as the case of Stuart Nozette. So my conclusion is there is no U.S. law that, if it stands in the way of Israel and its U.S. lobby, that cannot be thwarted, overcome, and the Justice Department, in most cases, collapses well before any warranted prosecutions take place.
That was Grant Smith, Executive Director of the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. Grant Smith has been leading the current efforts begun under President Kennedy and ended by Lyndon Johnson to force AIPAC to register as a foreign agent. Alison Weir is president of the Council for the National Interest. It was created by ambassadors and former congressmen in 1989. And she is executive director of If Americans Knew. That's a nonprofit organization she founded following her independent investigation as a freelance journalist to the West Bank and Gaza in early 2001. What she found on the ground differed so dramatically from what the U.S. media report that she came to the conclusion that, quote, if Americans knew the history and present reality of Palestine under Israeli occupation, U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East would no longer be so one-sidedly supportive of Israel. She writes and speaks widely on Israel-Palestine and has given talks at Harvard, Yale, Stanford, UC Berkeley, and Georgetown. After a very personal introduction, Alison Weir gave an account of the history of Zionism inside the U.S. and how different branches of the government and judiciary, as high up as presidents and Supreme Court justices, interacted with the Zionists and promoted acceptance of a Jewish state in Palestine. Here's Alison Weir.
A movement called political Zionism, its adherents are called Zionists, has profoundly impacted my nation and others, and yet that many Americans do not even know exists. I discovered that political Zionism, a movement to create a Jewish state in Palestine, had begun in the late 1800s. And that by the early 1890s, there were organizations promoting this ideology in New York, Chicago, Baltimore, Milwaukee, Boston, Philadelphia, and Cleveland. By the 1910s, the number of Zionists in the U.S. approached 20,000 and included lawyers, professors, and businessmen, and was becoming a movement to which, as one historian put it, congressmen, particularly in the eastern cities, began to listen. That was the 1910s. By 1918, there were 200,000 Zionists in the U.S., and in 1948, there were nearly a million. While politicians from both parties increasingly saw Zionists as potential voters and donors to curry, or at least placate, the U.S. State Department opposed Zionism, believing it was counter to both U.S. interests and principles. President Taft's Secretary of State, Philander Knox, stated in 1912 that Zionism involved matters primarily related to the interests of countries other than our own. A U.S. commission that studied the situation in Palestine in 1919 concluded the project for making Palestine distinctly a Jewish commonwealth should be given up. In 1947, American statesman Dean Acheson stated that supporting Zionist objectives would, quote, imperil not only American, but all Western interests in the Near East. The Joint Chiefs of Staff reported that a Zionist proposal, quote, would prejudice United States' strategic interests in the Near and Middle East, and predicted, quote, the Zionist strategy will seek to involve the United States in a continuously widening and deepening series of operations. Such memos and reports go on and on and on from the State Department, the Pentagon, and elsewhere. During this time, however, Zionists were working strenuously and ultimately successfully to combat such wise recommendations. They employed a wide range of stratagems, from open public advocacy to various covert activities. Their initiatives targeted every sector of the American population, including Jewish Americans, the large majority of whom for many decades were either non-Zionist or actively anti-Zionist, and who still today most likely are misinformed on what is being done allegedly in their name. In 1943, a Zionist organization, in the words of its leader, launched a political and public relations offensive to capture the support of congressmen, clergy, editors, professors, business, and labor. A directive ordered, quote, in every community, an American Christian Palestine Committee must be immediately organized. An annual Zionist report crowed, we reach into every department of American life. Perhaps my most surprising discovery of so many surprising findings involves an extremely well-known and highly regarded Supreme Court Justice, Louis Brandeis. According to a 1978 article in the respected scholarly journal American Jewish Historical Quarterly by Dr. Sarah Schmidt, an Israeli professor of Jewish history at Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Israel, and a book by Peter Gross, former editor of Foreign Affairs, diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times, and associate at the JFK School of Government at Harvard. According to these sources and some others, Louis Brandeis was a leader of an elitist secret society called the Parashim, the Hebrew word for Pharisees and separate. According to Schmidt and Gross, this society promoted Zionism throughout the United States. Its initiates underwent, according to Dr. Schmidt, a solemn induction ceremony in which the inductee was told, quote, you are about to take a step which will bind you to a single cause for all your life. Until our purpose shall be accomplished, you will be fellow of a brotherhood whose bond you will regard as greater than any other in your life, dearer than that of family, of school, of nation. Supreme Court Justice Brandeis was a leader of that. Brandeis directed Zionist activities from his Supreme Court chambers secretly through his loyal lieutenants, one of whom eventually became a Supreme Court Justice himself, another especially influential Supreme Court Justice, Felix Frankfurter. A number of authors report that Brandeis was a close friend of President Woodrow Wilson and used his access to advocate for the Zionist cause, at times serving as a conduit between British Zionists and the president. In fact, some Zionist leaders bragged, and many British officials, high governmental officials, rightly or wrongly, believed that Zionists had played a significant role in the U.S. decision to enter World War I. Numerous individuals, both Jewish and Christian, attempted to oppose Zionist endeavors. One was Dorothy Thompson. According to the Britannica Encyclopedia, Thompson was one of the most famous journalists of the 20th century. She had graced the cover of Time magazine, had been profiled by America's top magazines, and was so well known that a Hollywood movie featuring Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy and a Broadway play starring Lauren Bacall were based on Dorothy Thompson. Thompson had been the first journalist to be expelled by Adolf Hitler and had raised the alarm against the Nazis long ahead of most other journalists. She had originally supported Zionism, but then had visited the region in person. She began to speak about the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians that Israel had violently forced out in its founding war to create a Jewish state on land that was already inhabited. Thompson was viciously attacked in an orchestrated campaign of what she termed career assassination and character assassination. She wrote, "It has been boundless, going into my personal life." Before long, her column and radio programs, her speaking engagements, and her family, and her fame were all gone. Today, she has largely been erased from history. In the coming decades, other Americans were similarly written out of history, forced out of office, their lives and careers destroyed. History was distorted, rewritten, erased, bigotry promoted, supremacy disguised, facts replaced by fraud. Very few people know this history. The excellent books that document it are largely out of print, their facts and very existence virtually unknown to the vast majority of Americans. Instead, false theories have been promulgated, mendacious analyses promoted, chosen authors celebrated, others assigned to oblivion. George Orwell once wrote, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. Perhaps by rediscovering the past, we'll gain control of the present and make a better future for all our children." Thank you.
That was Allison Weir, Executive Director of If Americans Knew and President of the Council for the National Interest. Her book, Against Our Better Judgment, was published in February 2014. She and Grant Smith were the lead organizers of the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. It was held on March 7, 2014, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. And that's where the two talks you just heard were recorded. Find more information on Allison Weir at www.ifamericansknew.org. The Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, directed by Grant Smith, is at www.irmep.org. That's IRMEP.org. These links are also on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. You can find video and audio for all speakers at the day-long conference on the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship on the web at www.natsummit.org. That's NATSUMMIT.org. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and free as podcast online. This is an unfunded program that depends entirely on donations by listeners. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.